Just a quick note before we begin today. This episode talks about suicide and sexual assault.
Good afternoon.
Hi, I was wondering if I could talk to...
One moment, please.
Thanks. Oh, this is some dramatic on-hold music. Whoa. Dude, I got feelings, man. And that was Brahms in E-flat major with a soliloquy for the moon. Up next is Handel's music for Cooking Dope 2. I'm Garth Mullins. This is Crackdown. Episode 44, Kids on the Block, Part 3. Danny. That's good. Hello?
How are you?
Hey, this is Garth calling from Crackdown.
Nice meeting you, Garth.
This is Danny, or that's the alias we're giving them anyway. Danny is a young queer person in their early 20s, and we call them as part of our ongoing series on young people who use drugs in Canada, because we heard they had a powerful story to tell us. When we called Danny, they explained they're living in a residential recovery center in eastern Canada, and they say it's got a kind of summer camp vibe.
It's a busy day today. I just came back from volleyball.
Oh, wow. Do you need a minute to catch your breath or have a glass of water or something?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
And what does it look like there? Like, can you describe the place a little?
It's sort of like in the middle of nowhere, but like it's surrounded by nature. They're cutting the grass right now. I'm sorry if it, I don't know if you hear it or not, but.
Yeah, I do hear it. Yeah. The story starts around 2010, when Danny was still just a kid growing up in a Middle Eastern country. We're going to be vague about some of the place names in this episode to protect Danny's identity, but it was an extremely theocratic place to grow up. And Danny says their parents were pretty religious and conservative. Back then, Danny understood two things to be true. One, they were definitely gay. And two, it was extremely important that no one found that out.
My teacher would tell me that what do we do in Sharia law, for example, how gay men are treated or what's their punishment, what kind of punishment you would get if you were gay.
And what is it?
So they dig in a hole and they put the man inside the hole and they stone to death.
So you were 10, 11, 12,
I was young.
Mm-hmm.
I was very young.
And you started to know this about yourself, but you also started to know if anybody found out you could be killed like that.
Yeah, it's dangerous to reveal or to say that I like men.
Danny couldn't imagine any kind of livable future. They shuddered when picturing an adult version of themselves, still hiding, still wearing a mask of straightness and masculinity every single day. But what was the alternative? Who could they talk to about any of this? How could they ever pursue the kind of life they wanted? And what would it cost them if they tried?
For me, I had needs that were not met. Needs of belonging, needs of safety, intimacy, love, that toxic mentality of boys don't cry. And my dad was physically abusive. It was crazy. I've been through a lot.
Danny's path to a better life started on the computer. When Danny was around 12 years old, they started to teach themselves English by watching movies and TV shows online. They remember particularly liking Skins, a melodramatic show about the lives of British teenagers.
You're just in time for the food.
Dad, Maxie's gay.
You've got a fantastic lambuna, you know? My wife made it because she knows how
Dad,
much you like it.
Did you hear me?
And the spices are just so hot, you know? Not too much, not too little.
I'm gay, Mr. Corral. I always have been.
As Danny's English improved, they started to chat with other queer kids on the internet, and they remember watching viral YouTube videos and vlogs of kids coming out of the closet.
Yeah, it was like a lot of the time where gay marriage is being legalized, you know, around the world. And it was just like, for me, I was really interested, you know. I was like, oh, I want their lives, shit. And so, yeah, I had to work on my English.
When Danny was 14 years old, their parents agreed to send them to Europe for a summer session of English classes. It was Danny's first chance to escape their parents and their government's watchful eye, if only for a couple of months. Danny remembers that the English program was full of rich kids from around the world. Some stayed with local families, while others, like Danny, lived in dorm rooms at the school.
And the coolest kid would smoke. I would go behind the building and we would smoke cigarettes. And that was like, we thought, like, you know, we're rock stars or whatever.
Danny remembers one kid in particular from this first trip to Europe. He was a guy from Brazil, or maybe Colombia. It's been years, so Danny can't quite say for sure. But they do remember that he was cute.
He was older than me. He was like a little bit older, like he was 16. He was kissing this girl, like, he was kissing her, or, like, you know, he was in his straight era, whatever. But he was looking at me, and I was like, okay. 2 weeks after, he's just starting telling everybody that I was his boyfriend or whatever. And I was like, oh, that's cute, okay.
Danny and this guy spent the summer hanging out and flirting. Danny was hoping it would go further than that, but they weren't really sure if it would. Then came the night of the big school dance.
It was a rainy day, I know that for sure. And I was like, listening to that song called Baby, I'm Faded. Obviously, there was no alcohol because we were all underage. But we managed to sneak some alcohol, of course, we did. And yeah, we just go back in the building just to drink and smoke.
With the sound of electropop thumping in the distance, one thing led to another, and they kissed. It was Danny's first time kissing another guy.
That was, you know, fuck. It was just so romantic and cute. I was living for it. I was like, yes, okay. And it was just a kiss, though.
A few weeks later, the summer semester ended and Danny's love affair was cut short. Danny remembers back home in the Middle East, being depressed for weeks. The only thing keeping them going was the knowledge they'd be able to go back to Europe next summer. Danny's trips to Europe were like a dress rehearsal for a new life. It wasn't just about hooking up with guys. Danny remembers, when they were there, they'd also let their faux masculine voice drop away. They'd speak more playfully, pitched up an octave. Danny also started to gesture more expressively with her hands when they talked. It was like they were discovering a new, more authentic version of themselves. A version that wasn't allowed to flourish back home. Europe, just like North America, can be a pretty homophobic place. It's got conversion therapy, religious zealots, and right-wing assholes, just like everywhere else. But Danny still felt a lot more comfortable there. It felt freeing to attend gay pride parades, surrounded by queer friends, right out there where anyone could see them.
People were kissing, people were just loving on each other, which was cute, and it was a shock. I mean, I'm used to seeing women, for example, covered completely in black, and women were like just, you know, wearing whatever they want. I was in awe.
What were you in awe of? What was shocking?
Well, it was also a sense of relief too, because I was like, whew, okay.
I'm not alone.
Exactly, I'm not alone, I can have a future. There's a possibility of me having a peaceful life, let's say, like the life I want. It's a nice memory.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. At 17, Danny could finally see the light at the end of the tunnel. It wouldn't be long until they were old enough to attend college, preferably somewhere in Europe. And while there, they'd gradually gain more power over their life, more financial independence, more maturity. But then an Instagram post fucked up their plan. Danny's parents had got hold of a picture of Danny at a gay pride parade. They were distraught and confused and demanding answers. Danny tried to reassure their parents that they weren't gay, but they could tell it wasn't exactly working. It was Danny's mom who came up with the plan. The family would hire an imam to come to the house, and they'd have him perform a kind of exorcism on Danny.
They thought my gayness was part of a mental disease, and they were trying to cure it.
What was this like? Was your whole family gathered around? Were you in a chair or a bed, or what was this like?
It was my mom, my dad, and my mom was behind the door. Mm-hmm. I was sitting down. I was on the floor, on the ground, and he would come and he would spit on me, and he would say the prayer, repeat the prayer, and then spit like that. Sorry, it's like the holy water thing.
The man droned on, repeating his prayers again and again. Danny could tell that everyone in the room was expecting them to do something. Maybe to leap up and start writhing around, like some kind of demon was coming out of their body.
But no, I was sitting still and I was not moving. I was like, with a little smirk kind of. And my dad was sitting in front of me with he looked very angry and he was looking at me and he was holding it in.
Eventually, the imam ran out of steam. And he told Danny's parents, it doesn't look like your kid is possessed after all.
That was pretty much it. And he got his money.
Right.
He got paid a mess.
And what did your dad do after that? Did he think, well, that matter's over? Or?
Well, he was like, well, because it was my mom's idea, so he was like, okay, so we did this as you suggested, and nothing came out. So, and my dad was like, but if I find out that it's true, whatever you were doing over there, you're going to regret it. And you might not even live to regret it.
That's, Danny, that's awful. I'm sorry.
Danny was living under a microscope, constantly being watched and scrutinized. Now 17 years old, they still had very little control over their life. Danny had never had a real job, and had always been more or less bankrolled by their father. And it often felt to Danny that their dad was using the money to control them. When it was time to go to college, Danny's dad sent them to a small town on the east coast of the United States. Danny attended the same school as one of their close family members, and they lived in the same apartment as well. That meant that Danny's parents could still keep tabs on them, even when they were off at college. But even under that kind of scrutiny, Danny decided they'd waited long enough, and it was time to stop hiding who they really were.
I'm not going to adjust my way of talking or the way I talk. Like, you know, I'm not going to adjust that in the U.S. No, I'm not going to do that.
And so Danny started to talk and gesture like they had back in Europe. They also opened a Twitter account where they'd sometimes rant about religion. Danny could tell all of this was getting under the skin of this one guy at school, a student who came from the same country as Danny.
He would say, like, oh, this is not acceptable, because I was walking around with with the rainbow flag. You're not going to get away with this. But I got on his nerves, and I kind of liked it that I got on his nerves. To me, like, I was like, you're just a bug.
Eventually, this guy threatened to call the consulate and let them know what Danny had been up to. Not long after that, Danny's relative came to them and said, can you please just tone it down a bit so that we don't get into trouble?
He doesn't want people to look at me and start talking.
Mm-hmm.
This is how patriarchy works, and it's pretty strong in where I come from, you know.
Danny was stuck. It seemed pretty clear. If they kept being themselves, someone was going to rat. And that would likely mean being compelled to travel back to the Middle East and face the consequences. Maybe even the kind of lethal consequences that Danny had been threatened with their whole life.
I was getting depressed because I don't like being locked in this small, tiny town in the U.S.
It must have felt like you couldn't escape.
Yeah, it was like a dead end. Like, I was decided that this was it, and there was a bunch of pills. My depression pills were there. My anxiety pills, too, they were there. And there was alcohol, and I tried to kill myself that day because I was done. I was fed up. I thought there was no other way I could go.
Wow. And
at least if I die like with pills and from like let's say suicide, it would be better than me being killed in such a terrible, gruesome, like bloody way. I don't want to die like that. I want to keep my face intact. Yeah, it's such an ugly way to die.
Oh, it's awful.
Danny doesn't remember much about the moments after they took the pills. They figure they must have blacked out. When Danny woke up, they were in a hospital bed, alone. They felt dizzy and lightheaded, but they also felt a striking sense of relief.
I was so happy that I was, you know, alive. I wasn't depressed.
But when Danny arrived back at their apartment, they discovered that their parents now knew everything. While Danny had been unconscious, their relative had called them and told them about the suicide attempt. And she'd also told them that Danny was gay. Danny's family member explained what was going to happen next. Their parents would cut Danny off financially, and they'd do everything they could to get Danny to come back home. They might even talk to the government to see if they could get Danny's student visa canceled. Out of desperation, Danny asked to borrow a few $100. Their relative reluctantly agreed, but pleaded with Danny not to do anything stupid with the money.
I was like, I'm going to die. I have to do something. I started running. I literally started running. I had so much energy. I took a plane to another city in the U.S., closer to the border, and there was a blizzard going on outside. Like, this is how I arrived in the airport.
Did you have warm clothes? Did you have, like, a parka or a mitts or anything like that?
I did have warm clothes, but they were kind of made for European winter.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God, I was trying to get on a bus that takes you right to the border, like the Canadian mm-hmm. border. There was a person who helped me, and that person was actually from the same country, and he was gay, and he actually paid for me to go to the border.
Wow.
Sitting on the bus, Danny planned the next steps out in their head. They'd walk up to the border, talk to a guard, and they'd tell them, "I want to apply to become a refugee." When the bus pulled up at the border crossing, it was snowing furiously. Danny knew this was a make or break moment, and they had no idea whether their plan was going to work.
I just saw the guards over there. I told them that I need your protection from going back to my country. I need protection. I'm seeking asylum.
Wow. And what did they say?
She was like, okay. They took my passport. They searched me. They fingerprinted me and everything. And it was like an investigation. Oh, my God. For 2 days.
For 2 days, they questioned you and wait and looked up information, and you were sitting in the waiting room.
Yeah, I mean, it was really scary, especially when I see people that are being returned, like being mm-hmm. kicked out in front of me. And I was like, okay, this person came before me. Now he's being kicked out.
Wow.
I still had hope, though. I mean.
Yeah.
The border agents kept asking Danny if they had any relatives in Canada. Danny says, no, I don't think so, racking their brain to recall the edges of their family tree. But then it dawned on them. They did have one relative that they'd heard move to Canada. And the agents seemed to perk up when Danny mentioned his name. Danny spent the next several hours oscillating between anxiously smoking outside in the cold and huddling in the border office. Until, finally, one of the agents told Danny, we have some good news.
They were like, okay, welcome to Canada. And that was a huge moment of relief. I was like...
Oh, Danny, I'm so glad that they said yes and let you in.
Yeah.
You're hearing footage from a press conference held back in 2019. At the press conference, Canada's then Minister of Foreign Affairs, Chrystia Freeland, hugged a Saudi teenager named Rahaf Al-Kunan. Rahaf was queer and had renounced Islam. And for that, she said, her family wanted to put her to death.
And Rahaf wanted Canadians to see that she's arrived at her new home, but she's had a very long and tiring journey. And so she would prefer not to take questions today. So please respect.
Canada, as you know, has been closely following the situation with Ms. Rahaf Al-Kunun. The UNHCR has made a request of Canada that we accept Ms. Al-Kunun as a refugee, and we have accepted.
Justin Trudeau confirming a Saudi teen is coming to Canada after her plea for asylum, made on social media in real time, gained international attention.
With an election looming, Rahaf's arrival into Canada was a real gift for the Liberal Party. It offered Trudeau a chance to project a defiant, powerful image on the world stage. And it drew a clear moral distinction between our country and the kind of theocratic regimes that Rahaf and Danny were fleeing.
Canada has been unequivocal that we will always stand up for human rights and women's rights around the world. This is part of a long tradition of Canada engaging constructively and positively in the world and working with our partners, allies, and with the United Nations.
But what happens after newcomers arrive in Canada? Many refugees, immigrants, temporary foreign workers, and international students find themselves struggling to survive our brutal neoliberal cities, where they are hyper-exploited by their employers, and where dignified housing is often out of young people's reach, especially young people who don't have any financial help from their parents. Immigrants, refugees, and international students are also threatened by our country's toxic drug supply.
An international student from Turkey says he turned to drugs just 17 days after moving to Saskatoon. And a Syrian refugee says he uses meth to forget his problems. Both men say they felt alone and had no supports.
Unlike Rahaf, Danny didn't have a large Twitter following when they arrived in Canada. They weren't greeted by any officials or the media when they were accepted into the country. Instead, they told border agents they didn't have any money, and they asked them where they should go next. The agents gave Danny the address for a nearby homeless shelter.
That's where they sent me to. I was with my luggage, with my stuff and everything, and I was like, I just had the impression of like not to trust anyone because I would see people fighting and stealing from each other. I've never seen that part of Canada. Let's say, I don't know, but I didn't know it was like this.
Not too long after Danny arrived at the shelter, their dad called on the phone. He asked, where did you go? And Danny told the truth. I've run away to Canada so that you won't be able to make me come back home.
He was saying, like, why would you do this? Yeah, he was trying to convince me, and he was actually saying that you could go to any university you want, anywhere, just point on the map and it'll send you there. You will go there, but just don't make that move, seeking asylum in Canada. And he was begging me not to cut contact. I was just like, no, actually, no, I don't believe in the bullshit you believe in. That's first. Second, I don't trust you. You abused me. You beat me up. Yeah, it was too much. I was like, no, yeah, why are you surprised that I don't trust you? Like, I don't trust you. You lost that. You gave it away. You wasted it.
And like, how did your life then compare with when your parents were still supporting you?
Okay, so I never had to work before, and I never had to really do a budget. And maybe it would have been better if I did in the past, but I kind of never learned those things.
In Danny's new life, everything was flipped. Now they didn't have any financial freedom at all. They had to get a shitty job working at a call center that barely kept them off the street. But now Danny was much freer in other ways. They started to go out and meet other queer kids in the city. They remember a kind of blur of clubs, raves, and after parties.
So can you take us to one of that first rave or something like that?
Ooh, okay. So it was sort of like queer party. Like everyone would go there. Like, I don't know why, but I wore like a black dress, actually.
How did it feel the first time?
I mean, it was exciting.
Uh-huh.
The people, the kissing, I guess that. People fucking in the field, like people expressing themselves and dancing and like showing off outfits, and it was really cute.
Danny was new to all this stuff. To this point in their life, they'd really only experimented with alcohol a little bit. But the queer club scene came with a whole world of new options.
Started with Coke, and then the Coke would fade away, and then somebody would be like, oh, would you like a bomb of K? And da, 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 would you like a Molly? And I'm like, whoa, okay, I really like this. It was fun, it was exciting, and the music sounded different.
Like what?
I don't know, you could feel the music in techno music. I would feel it in my heart, especially like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a relief. It was pleasure, and it was.
You said it was relief. That really resonates with me. Like some of the best moments I've had are not the drug itself, but the ending of all the shit that the drug temporarily shut off. You know, can you describe that relief?
It felt like I didn't have anything to worry about. Numb, 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 numb.
But Danny's life wasn't a party every day. When Danny's work permit lapsed, they found themselves boxed out of any kind of real job during the height of COVID-19. Danny spent almost every night completely alone, with no family to call for help, living right on the edge of homelessness. They were where so many other young Canadians found themselves, just above the age of government care, parentless, unemployable, and left to fend for themselves. It was like Canada had stopped caring about Danny the moment after they let them in. And so, like many other young people in that kind of spot, Danny turned to sex work.
I had no choice. The government was taking forever to renew a work permit, just to renew it, almost 5-6 months.
Right.
Yeah, I had rent to pay, and I wasn't even on welfare, like, when I would go and hook up with people, like over Grindr, which is an app for like a dating app, and there's a lot of drugs on there. I would hear a lot about meth. Tina, they call her Tina. I don't know why they call her Tina, but
I think originally it comes from Crystal, Christina, you know, like anyway.
Yeah. I tried it for the first time and it was so intense, really strong. Like I was talking for hours. I was imagining, like planning, like I was so hyped. I was, whoa, in La La Land.
Danny says meth seemed a lot harsher than MDMA, but there was no question it was going to be useful. This is something researchers have found again and again. Some people like meth, but lots of people think of it more like a kind of tool for survival. If you've just been evicted, if you got to spend all night dumpster diving, or if you got to take a bunch of sketchy dates, meth will keep you going.
It became something I would do once a month, and then it became every 2 weeks. Yeah, I was literally having sex to get crystal meth, and I was doing crystal meth to have sex. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Yep. When I was in my 20s, late teens, early 20s, I didn't realize that doing sex for drugs was sex work.
Yeah.
And then when I started doing it for money, then I realized, oh, and I had friends, including friends who told me, because I just like to do heroin, but they said, if you do crystal meth, then it will make it, it'll make you sparkly. It will make you look like you are more interested in being with somebody who maybe you don't really want to be with.
Yeah, it gets you through it. It's got me through those clients. Yeah.
And did you ever take clients that you wouldn't have otherwise taken because of this?
Most of the time, to be honest, I made really, really impulsive decisions,
right.
Especially when I was coming down from meth, like going to the sauna to take more clients. I would wake up sometimes and just not know where I am. That happened. I might have been raped at that.
Oh, Jesus. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Sorry. It's all right.
Meth helped Danny get through these kinds of dark and traumatic experiences. But Danny would read news stories about the overdose crisis. And they'd hear about people who bought meth and were sold fentanyl instead. Sometimes, Danny would hear that those people had died. So Danny started to carry naloxone with them wherever they went. And they'd also bring new pipes and needles. Danny says they got in the habit of grabbing whatever harm reduction supplies they could, even stuff they didn't personally need, so that they could make sure that their friends stayed safe.
We have this, the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, you know, the opposition party in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. If he gets elected, he wants to defund safe supply programs. There's a lot of people writing in the national newspapers, you know, the Post media chain. They're saying that harm reduction and safe injection sites, this sort of stuff, it's like a threat to youth. And they have kind of this old, very old-fashioned idea. And so they want to shut down all these kinds of programs, you know.
Yeah, I don't think it's a really bad idea. Like, this will only worsen the problem. I think they should do the opposite.
What kind of difference would it have made to you if you had been able to access a safe supply of crystal meth?
I wouldn't have gotten into a lot of dangerous situations I put myself in just to get that drug. Maybe I would have gotten into a recovery program earlier than I really did.
So safe supply could have led you to a recovery program quicker?
I think so. Yes. Every time you need the drug, you would go into that place where you get your safe supply, and you would know that those people are there to help you, and you can at least like have a conversation. For me, that really got me into recovery. It was just a random conversation with my social worker. That's how it started.
Mm.
2 years in my drug addiction did a lot of wrecked havoc. It was really, really bad. And I'm like, no, I need to find a solution to this. So it would have made a huge difference.
Last year, Danny decided enough was enough. And they checked themselves into a somewhat remote residential recovery center. They prepared themselves for what could be the hardest challenge of their life, kicking meth. But it didn't turn out to be as hard as they were expecting. After months of living in the facility, playing volleyball, talking about root causes with counselors, and taking dialectical behavioral therapy, Danny graduated from the program. Now Danny spends a lot of their time going to recovery meetings and exercising to burn off anxious energy. Danny has been sober for about 8 months. Danny's also recently got a job sewing bags, and they're considering maybe going back to school. But for now, Danny says they're just trying to take things slow, and that approach seems to be working. They feel happy and healthy, and earlier this year, they got their Canadian permanent residence card.
Are you angry at your family?
I am upset. I'm not angry. I mean, I am. I'm sad. I hadn't forgiven my dad. I will accept it. I'm trying to accept it as part of my past, but I might never forgive him or forgive all of them for what had happened. I mean, to accept it is one thing and to forgive is another.
Mm-hmm. You know, you sharing your story like this with us has been, I don't know, it's been really incredible. Like it's so amazing the journey that you've made, and we've just been blown away by hearing your story here. And it's also like just telling us all this stuff, and you never met me before. It's really amazing. I just wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah, sure. It was a pleasure, honestly. Thank you so much for giving me the mic, I guess.
Crackdown is produced on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Our editorial board is Simona Marsh, Shelda Castor, Jeff Loudon, Dean Wilson, Laura Shaver, Raya Jean, Delilah Gregg, Martin Stewart, and Ryan Maddow. Rest in peace, Dave Murray, Greg Frez, and Cherise Kiwatin. This month, we also need to say goodbye to three drug user activists. Rest in peace to Clint, Crystal, and Cecil. We will miss you. This episode was conceptualized, written, and produced by Sam Fenn, Alex DeBoer, Rebecca Haynes-Saw, Lisa Hale, Dania Fast, and me, Garth Mullins. Score by James Ash and Sam Fenn. We talked to a lot of young activists while making this series. Special thanks to Kali Sedgemore, Annalena Clare, and Nadja Kassar, as well as Talia Lyons, Zara Lyons, Serena Lyons, and Ayla Martin from Youth for Youth Canada. And thanks once again to Bones, Jade, and Danny for sharing their stories with us. Today's episode was funded in part by the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, the Vancouver Foundation, and Michael Smith Health Research BC. If you like what we do, support us at patreon.com/crackdownpod. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and keep six. Hey!